This is Press Publish, a weekly conversation about journalism, technology, and the media business, where we talk with the people building the future of news. I'm Josh Benton, director of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard. This is episode 5. My guest this week is Chris Anderson. You may know him by his byline C.W. Anderson, because there are too many Chris Andersons in the journalism and technology worlds. Chris is a professor of media culture at CUNY and a longtime Nieman Lab contributor, but for our purposes today, he's mostly here as the author of a new book looking at the decline of major metro newspapers, specifically through the lens of Philadelphia. It's called Rebuilding the News, Metropolitan Journalism in the Digital Age, and it's just out from Temple University Press. Chris is an ethnographer by trade, so he spent a lot of time hanging out in the major newsrooms of Philadelphia, mainly its two daily newspapers, the Broadsheet Inquirer and the Tabloid Daily News, and spending a lot of time with the bloggers and the startups who were just starting to provide the audience with new alternatives in local news. His book is a great window into how newspapers and newspaper culture, really, responded to the new competition and to their own financial declines. It's also a look at how the optimism that some felt just a few years ago, that there would be these new institutions to rise up to replace the declining old ones, how that optimism has shifted into a slightly gloomier mood. We talked about how he did his research, his other work with the likes of Clay Shirky and Emily Bell, and how his own thinking about journalism institutions has evolved over time. Here's our conversation. Chris, how did you get started being interested in journalism in general and, you know, journalism academia more specifically?
Right. So it could be a long story or a long story or a short story.
How about medium? We don't want to take up the whole hour.
Right. You know, so I started off in community organizing, actually, and that's what I did right out of college. I did AmeriCorps VISTA for a year in Houston, and then I did some housing-related community organizing work also in Houston and then in New Jersey. And while I was doing that, this was sort of the late 90s, early 2000s, and I was getting increasingly, you know, sort of interested in the way that I, as an organizer, was getting or not getting my message out and sort of the new digital tools that were available for me to get or not get that message out. So I actually started kind of becoming a user of and a person who was interested in, you know, what we called at the time called alternative media. You know, I wasn't calling it blogging or citizen journalism or anything like that. But, you know, there was this whole kind of lefty tradition of kind of alternative media from, you know, shows like Democracy Now! And WBAI, you know, to, you know, community newspapers and things like that. So I got interested in, you know, what are the new ways or what are the ways that people are trying to kind of get their messages out? And, you know, that increasingly started shading over into the internet. You know, I started to see people using, you know, and I knew what the internet was. I used it a lot, you know, in college to send email and to buy things and to, you know, find chats and forums and you know, places where people hung out and talked about bands I liked. But I didn't really start seeing anyone using the internet for a journalistic, you know, in a journalistic way or for a, you know, a way to communicate or to, you know, get their messages out there until, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s. And then I started to notice this more and more. So I, you know, was both kind of interested in what was going on. I was, you know, sort of like, how can I use this in my own, you know, political work? And that kind of sparked a greater intellectual interest in how these, you know, new and old technologies, you know, what were the sort of history of these technologies, you know, going very far back, how were these new digital technologies changing the way information got produced, information got made, you know, and circulated around in the larger sort of political space. You know, and from there, it was kind of like, you know, okay, I've been, you know, doing this organizing for a couple years, I can actually probably make more money getting a graduate student stipend than I can as a community organizer, unfortunately. So,
I'm surprised you didn't take the other career route of the community organizer and just become president.
Yeah, well, that is, you know, that you know, Barack Obama has opened up a lot of paths for a lot of people, you know, and I guess that was one, you know, you can become president. But, you know, I didn't know that at the time. So I just decided to go to get my PhD instead, which was probably a better move both for myself and for the country. So that's kind of the backstory, you know, and I guess the point is just that I was interested in kind of this idea of the larger media ecosystem, you know, both the traditional journalistic players and the new entrants and the kind of alternative media makers, you know, as a user and as a person who was politically engaged. So I sort of came to the internet and came to the changes in journalism with that kind of already operating in the background. And I was kind of very sensitive to who the different players were and how they interacted and how, you know, if something gets reported in a, you know, on a blog or in an alt-weekly newspaper, you know, how does that affect the New York Times, you know, if at all? I think that was kind of the key question for me.
So do you feel that the fact that you approached a lot of journalism questions coming from a place of, you know, from a place of advocacy, of thinking of journalistic work or news work as being an instrument towards something else? Do you think that's influenced the way that you might have, you know, gone about your academic work and the issues that you're interested in and how you approach them?
Yeah, I definitely think, you know, it's sort of, to me, all journalism, you know, is inherently political. You know, I was never disillusioned. I never had a moment of disillusionment with objectivity, I guess. You know, there was never, you know, I was never kind of a believer in objective journalism. And then, you know, had a moment where I was sort of shattered and, you know, was like, oh my gosh, this is, you know, this is not even true. this is all a fraud. You know, and then I kind of found the light of journalism as a political thing. It's sort of the opposite. I actually started off believing in journalism as a almost entirely an instrument of politics, you know, and became more sympathetic actually to the idea of objectivity and objective journalism as I went along, you know, and as I started to study journalists and study how they thought about what they did and how, you know, what they understood objectivity to mean. You know, I started off not believing it in any way and thinking it was all just a, you know, a load. And kind of as I actually took the time to understand the way journalism worked, got a more nuanced conception of it and, you know, maybe was sympathetic to it in a way I hadn't been, you know, before I started my research. Which is not to say, you know, necessarily, you know, my views on objectivity would be loved and endorsed by everybody at the New York Times. But it, you know, it certainly, you know, it was sort of interesting to go through that process backwards rather than the other way around, I guess.
Right. You're a journalistic Benjamin Button.
Kind of, yeah.
It's interesting in the context of your book, which is part of what we're talking about, Rebuilding the News, in which you spend a fair amount of time detailing the self-conception of journalists and how they view their work through a lens that involves objectivity and involves this idea of a mass public. And it's interesting that you say you've sort of moved ever so slightly or somewhat in that direction. Let's shift a little bit to Philadelphia, yeah. Which is where you're doing your work. And this book is your PhD, your dissertation turned into a book, right?
It is, yes. Yeah. As much as one can, you know, de-dissertate a thing, you know, a 300-page thing, I have tried to do that here, you know, and make it interesting and readable for your kind of average everyday person. Right. We'll see if I succeeded or not.
Or at least the average everyday Neiman Lab reader. That'd be
correct.
That'd
yes.
be fine.
Right.
The book is about the journalistic and the media ecosystem in Philadelphia. I guess why Philadelphia? Why'd you decide on that? There are lots of cities in the world.
Sure. You know, there's the good academic reason and then there's the honest reason, which is not entirely far from the good academic reason. The good academic reason is that, you know, in academia, there's always this, you know, idea of, you know, how much can you generalize what you're studying, right? So can what you're studying, you know, be said to apply to, you know, the entire universe, you know, at all times and places? And you know, sort of the gold standard in traditional academia is generalizability, right? You want to say that, you know, what you found applies not just to what you studied, but to the larger world. You know, when you do ethnographic research, which is what I did, which basically, for those who don't know, you know, is kind of long-term immersion in a particular place where you sort of study the natives, you know, and for me, the natives were journalists. But anyway, so that's what ethnography is. That's the kind of research I did. And when you do ethnographic research, you know, generalizability is always kind of fraught anyway, right? Because it's more about studying one smaller thing in depth than it is about, you know, being able to say this is true in all times, all places, forever and ever. That said, though, you do want to try to say, you know, hey, maybe what I found does apply elsewhere. So the point of this is to say that I was living in New York. I had a very, you know, strong sense that the way the media was in New York City was unlike the way the media was anywhere else in the world, with the possible exception of, you know, London and Moscow and, you know, Beijing and, you know, kind of these world cities. But local journalism, city journalism in New York was inevitably, you know, national news to some degree, you know, which so New York isn't like other places. And to me, you know, I wanted to study news in a city. And to me, Philadelphia was more like other cities where the news was sort of dealing with all these digital questions than New York was. So, I mean, it could have been Philadelphia. It could have been Baltimore. It could have been, you know, maybe even Boston, although Boston has its own idiosyncrasies. Or, you know, it could have been Des Moines or you know, Austin, Texas, or, you know, probably New Orleans, you know, your home hometown. you know, so Philadelphia just seemed more average than New York did. So that was kind of the academic reason. The slightly less academic reason was that I made contacts there to do ethnography well. And, you know, we can talk about this more if you want. But to do ethnography well, you have to get in there. You know, you have to be able to get to a point where people trust you enough to just kind of hang around and watch them for, you know, years, basically. I was able to do that in Philadelphia. So that was sort of another reason. The third and final and totally unacademic reason was that my parents live in the Philadelphia suburbs over in New Jersey. And so I could stay with them while I was doing the research for free, you know, so I had a place to stay. And as a broke PhD student, you know, living with your parents while, you know, sort of spiritually demoralizing is financially a good idea. So, you know, I was 30 years old. I was, you know, living in my parents' basement and, you know, going out and hanging out in newsrooms every day. So it was sort of a weird, you know, I can't say I'm sad that those days are over, but, you know, it was a good way to get research done. And, you know, the other nice thing about it was that there was absolutely nothing going on, you know, in Haddon Township, New Jersey, to distract me from my scholarship. So those are sort of the three reasons why I picked Philly.
Oh, the things we do in the quest for knowledge.
It's true.
Because I think Philadelphia is an interesting. I mean, certainly Philadelphia is more normal, if we can put normal in a series of scare quotes, normal than New York as a media ecosystem. But it's also. I mean, Philadelphia is a very large market. It's what the fifth or sixth largest market in the country. It's a two newspaper town, which is interesting and from a, you know, more things to look at point of view, but it's still sort of the exception to the rule.
Right.
It's, you know, has had, I think, probably a more vibrant online news ecosystem than a lot of other cities. And it's interesting to me to think, what if you were in, I don't know, Hartford or, you know, Oklahoma City or some city that wasn't quite as vibrant, how the story might be different.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's totally true. And you know, sort of the inevitable and some kind of unfortunate defense of scholarship like this is to say, you know, well, more research is needed, right? but you know, in all seriousness, you know, I know Dan Kennedy has just finished a book on kind of independent independent news production. I think in Massachusetts,
in New Haven,
Yeah, so. You know, I mean, that's kind of another take. That's sort of another, in some ways, is exactly your question. You know, so he's looking at, again, I mean, New Haven itself is exceptional in all these different ways. Obviously, you know, Yale is there. But, you know, so I'm kind of personally interested, you know, to read Dan's book when it comes out and see, you know, and kind of compare it in my own mind, you know, and see, you know, what did he find that was the same? What did he find that was different? You know, and what about this may relate to, you know, differences in time, differences in what we studied, but also differences in the places we were in. You know, so yeah, I think that, you know, with this kind of research, you hope that at least a few other people will study roughly similar things, so you can start to compare them.
Yeah. So you described your work accurately as ethnographic. That is a style of research that I think is probably at least a few steps closer to traditional journalistic work than some other forms of academic work. Can you describe what exactly you're doing? So, like, you know, how many days were you spending in the Inquirer newsroom? How much time are we talking about?
Sure. It is, ethnography is definitely, about as close to journalism as academic research gets, and that, is good and bad, and it can, be used as a way to delegitimize it in some ways within the academy, actually. That's actually another conversation we can have later. The similarity between ethnography and journalism, on the one hand, journalists understand completely what you're doing, but on the other hand, there are differences between journalism and ethnography, and sometimes, journalists think you're doing exactly what they do, and you're not quite doing journalism. In terms of what you actually do, on an average day, I would get up, at the crack of dawn, and I would take the train over into Philadelphia, and I would sit in a cafe in the very early morning and transcribe all my notes from the day before. I would go back and listen to the tape, and I wouldn't do an exact transcription right then, but I would, listen to the tape I'd put together, and I would, find places that were important, and I'd go back to my notes, and I would write down, 1 minute and 32 seconds on this day, this is important, go back and listen to this later. And I was able to do that pretty easily because, journalists, traditional print newspapers are not notoriously early risers. they didn't usually get into the office till about 10 or 10:30. So I had the whole morning to do note transcription while they were, preparing to start their day.
That's why many of us got into journalism, just so you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's actually a whole, one of the interesting things I noticed very early on was just the different time regimens of the online and the more traditional print folks. Mm. The online folks would start, 6, 7 a.m. They would be there in the office, doing this, spinning the homepage, as they put it, playing to that early morning crowd and early morning, audience. And then sort of the print reporters would roll in at 10, 10:30. And it just created sort of a very different work dynamic between these two groups, and was actually one of the ways that they sort of distinguished themselves from each other, right? And that's maybe, not worth getting into at this point. But yeah, there was definitely a difference in time regimens between the on and the offline folks. So, so I would get in and, I kind of, when I started, I had this idea that I would get to the office. They gave me a desk kind of in the center of the – there were plenty of desks in the Philadelphia newsrooms because they had lost, about a third of their staff at that point. They've lost more since then. I would get in. I would show up. I would go to my desk. Some days I would deliberately set out to shadow people. And what that means is I would find a particular reporter who I thought was doing interesting things, or I would find a particular reporter who was, working with the online team in a particularly interesting way or a particularly meaningful way. And I would kind of shadow her or him across the day. And sometimes I would just shadow somebody one day. Sometimes I would shadow them a whole week. So that was sort of one, and by shadow, I mean, you follow them around, as they are, doing something. If there's a way to do this so it doesn't totally interrupt them, you say, "So why'd you do that? What does that mean? Why did you ask that person that question instead of this other question? What is that notebook for? When do you go to your computer?" Really just kind of basic, obvious, probably really annoying questions like that. And you kind of follow the person from place to place across their day. So that was one kind of angle on it. Another angle on it was you would just sort of sit in the newsroom and you would just listen to what was going on, and you would, kind of just try to take the whole newsroom in. And, as you heard something interesting coming up, you would kind of wander over and be like, "Hey, what's going on? What are you guys talking about? Tell me more." Which in some ways, again, is very similar to what journalists do. I can get to the differences in a second. That – so ethnography can last, you know, anywhere from a couple months to a couple years. The stuff done in the 1970s tended to be longer lasting. Folks like Herb Gans had more time and more funding and more ability to just go to a newsroom for, you know, 3 years and do this. We don't have that time. Even as doctoral students, we didn't have that time. So I was in Philadelphia for about 6 months doing this, from the early spring to the end of the summer, in 2008. And then, you know, there was research before that that was primarily interview-based, where I just interviewed a lot of the people in the larger media ecosystem. And then there were multiple kind of follow-up visits everywhere from, you know, 2009 till today, where I would, you know, go back for a week and kind of do a little mini ethnography, or I would get interviews done. You know, so there were kind of regular follow-ups every few months just to kind of, you know, be like, what's changed, what hasn't changed, what stayed the same. So yeah, so that's sort of in a nutshell what you do as a ethnographer.
And it seems like there's a tension at a certain level between doing ethnography, which is of its nature immersion in an environment, and at the same time doing something that is focused on a larger media ecosystem, mm-hmm. where there are lots of different players, not just the Inquirer. I'm curious how you divvied up your time among, you know, I assume you spent the largest portion of your time at the Inquirer, but, you know, who are the other places that you spent more time in?
You know, I actually ended up spending the majority of my time at the Daily News, believe it or not,
okay.
The Philadelphia Daily News, for a lot of reasons. I mean, one of them just being that the Daily News was a lot more relaxed when it came to, you know, me hanging around. They just, you know, tabloid guys, they were just like, sure, come on in as long as you want. We don't care. You know, you want to work, you know, and the Inquirer.
We had a shooting. You want to go out on it?
Yeah. Right. Exactly. No, you know, and I mean, you know, the Inquirer being a broadsheet, you know, was definitely a little more buttoned up in a good way, but definitely a little more, you know, a little more self-conscious of my presence there. You know, a little more like, you know, how long are you going to be here? Okay. Let's set a start date and an end date, you know, whereas the Daily News folks, you know, I could have stayed there for a year and they would have been happy for the company, I think, and, you know, happy to have somebody hanging around. But, you know, I was at both of those places a lot. You know, I did most of my larger ecosystem work before and after I got to the Inquirer and the Daily News. A lot of it was interview-based. There was some shadowing involved. Although it's, you know, what does it mean to shadow a blogger? not much, you know, you sit there and watch them type all day. But, you know, there is some stuff you get out of hanging around with bloggers. So a lot of that stuff happened early and a lot of that stuff happened afterwards. You know, my idea, I think, was basically to go to where the news was being produced, you know, and to follow the news back to where it was being made. And, you know, one of the interesting things about taking an ecosystem perspective on journalism as opposed to an institutional perspective on journalism is that ultimately, for me anyway, I kept getting led back to the institutions. In other words, you know, I didn't necessarily want to spend the majority of my time at the Inquirer and the majority of my time at the Daily News. But, you know, when it came to where is the majority of news in Philadelphia being produced, at least in 2008 – you know, and probably still even today, it was those traditional news institutions. So, you know, to find out where the news was getting made, you know, it sort of inevitably led me back to, you know, the Inquirer building. You know, which was itself a finding, and made me once again, you know, far more sympathetic to the ideas of folks like, you know, Alex Jones and Len Downey and Michael Shudson, who, you know, make this basic argument that, you know, whatever else you want to say about newspapers, they do produce a lot of the original reporting, you know, that we find in these cities. You know, that's just sort of inevitably the way it is. And I think I started out my research far less sympathetic to that argument. I was like, oh, these journalists, they're, you know, they're dinosaurs. They're on their way out. Good riddance, you know, be better when they're gone. And, you know, kind of by the end of my research, I was kind of like, oh, you know, that's not really – they're still, you know, they're still doing the majority of the work here. They're still producing most of the news. And it could be a real problem when they all go away.
Yeah. It's interesting. The arc that you're describing seems in some ways similar to the one that Clay Shirky's talked about having, your co-author on the Post-Industrial Journalism Report, about eventually coming around to the idea that institutions are, you know, not all terrible and provide an important role for a variety of reasons.
Yeah.
You wrote a couple posts for Nieman Lab. First, we ran an excerpt of the book, and then you wrote a post describing some of your findings. I want to sort of run through some of the things that you described as the themes through the book. The first one I want to talk about is journalist self-concept, I guess would be the best way to frame it. An excerpt from your introduction says, local journalism's vision of itself as an institutionally grounded profession that empirically informs and perhaps even assembles the public is a noble vision of tremendous democratic importance, but the unreflexive commitment to a particular and historically contingent version of this self-image now undermines these larger democratic aspirations.
Yeah.
I'm curious, you know, perhaps maybe you could tie it back to some of the specific ethnographic observations that you made, but what did you learn in the process of writing this book and doing the research for it about how journalists see themselves?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it can come up in interesting ways. I mean, basically what I found, and you sort of quoted it, and I can, you know, simplify it or rewrite it, you know, for the audience. You know, journalists had this idea that when it came to, you know, producing publicly relevant information, they were the only ones who did it. And they did it for kind of this mass audience that came to them and had nowhere else to go. And that came out a bunch of different little ways that sort of over the course of months and months and months, you know, sort of, you know, assembled themselves into a larger finding. It's hard to go back now and pull out those individual incidents. I mean, one thing that just comes to the top of my head pretty quickly is, you know, you would ask a journalist, you know, why is what you're doing, more important than, you know, what Joe Blogger down the street is doing, or what, you know, Celebrity is doing, which was a, you know, kind of like the Gawker of Philadelphia. You know, why is your work more important than theirs? You know, and they would they could have said a lot of things, but what they would often say is, you know, oh well, you know, we have, you know, X million number of page views a day. You know, and what do they have? You know, a couple thousand? You know, now this is not necessarily what you would expect, you know, a professional journalist to say. You'd expect them to say, you know, oh, well, you know, we do these things that are far more rigorous and far more serious and et cetera, et cetera. But what they were basically saying was, they were saying, our audience is bigger and we are the only people who speak to the city of Philadelphia as a mass, right? These other folks speak to little niches, and we speak to, you know, the mass of Philadelphia. You know, so that's one example that comes to the top of my head, which is how you ethnographically understand what a journalist's self-vision is. Another way to do it, you know, real quickly, I was in planning meetings for how, you know, they were going to redesign their website and how they were going to sort of rebuild their websites. You know, when you're in these planning meetings, that is a fascinating moment, because when you talk about the architecture of a website, when you're talking about the architecture of your website, and you as a person who you know, designs and redesigns Nieman Lab, you know this yourself, you know, you're automatically thinking about, you know, who's my audience? Who are we? What are we doing? And how do we build, you know, our own self-image? How do we bake our self-image into the architecture of this site, right? And they verbalized this in these meetings, you know. So that was another way of kind of getting at what journalists' image of themselves were in a concrete and, you know, and tangible way.
That's so interesting, because, I mean, at a certain level, I would have expected, and I think it fits very well into the history of thinking about metro newspaper journalism, that the mass and the public is another way to frame that, that assemblage of large numbers of people was very important. And I think in the US probably more important, because we have one newspaper cities and, mm-hmm. and this idea that it's not a collection of ideologies or ethnographic slices of the city, it's the city.
Yeah.
Even though Philadelphia has two newspapers that appeal to very different pieces of the city.
Yeah.
But it's – I mentioned that because for one thing, local television, by most measures, appeals to at least as massive an audience and a more massive audience when you take stations and put them together. And we're now in an environment where if you look at how people consume, let's say, news defined broadly online, I mean, the Huffington Post has a far broader reach than any metro newspaper. Like, you can just go down the list of websites that really do achieve more mass. So it's interesting to hear that the mass audience is that big of a conception. I would have expected a slightly more mission-driven, like the celebrity is not covering city council meetings, sort of a David Simon approach to that defense.
No, and that was definitely there. You know, and again, this is also in, you know, you need to remember this is, you know, 2008, 2009. So, you know, the internet had not quite reached that level where the Huffington Post was, you know, kicking mass audience butt the way, you know, the way it did for a while. But yes, there was also that, you know, it was sort of in the book I talk about, you know, and we might get to this in a second, but it was this combination of the idea of the public and reporting, right? So if you, you know, if you wanted to build yourself up, you talked about the public. And if you wanted to tear other people down, you talked about original reporting. And the way you tore, you know, celebrity down, or even the way you tore down TV news in particular, you know, as someone who's building your own occupational self-image, was to say, well, they don't do reporting. You know what I mean? Those folks on TV, they don't really do reporting. They get their reporting from us. And then they go to the side of the road and, you know, sort of add pictures to the reporting that we've already done.
Right.
Celebrity, they're aggregators. You know, they do aggregation. You know, so that was the flip side of it. They would, at the same time, they would say, you know, we are have a mass audience and we do reporting.
Yeah. Did you, you know, it's an old hobby horse of mine that that journalists often don't quite conceive of anything that they do as being aggregation, because of that the idea of original reporting. Whereas, I mean, a not insignificant portion of stories in a daily newspaper are based on press releases and press conferences and events that are created to hand things to the media.
Yep.
And there's an active questioning going on, but nonetheless, it is. And even when you go to a reported story, you're assembling what this expert says in reaction to this press release and whatever else. Was there any vision of that sort of? That vision of that, while we do create value independently, we're also performing the work of assembling pieces of value from lots of other sources and presenting it to a public?
No. that was, you know, and that's the thing that I want to do more research on, you know, down the road, because I still find that question of reporting so interesting. You know, that, no. You know, and in fact, it was almost the opposite. You know, you when you first had, you know, bloggers, people with the title of you know, blogger get jobs at the Philadelphia newspapers, at the Daily News, at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Almost all of them were bloggers who were doing what they saw as original reporting, and they would talk about their blogs as simply a way to further their primary mission, which was original reporting, and to, you know, to, as part of that entire package. Now, we all know, you know, Will Bunch, many Neiman Lab readers might know, you know, the guy in Philadelphia Daily News runs a blog called Attitude. He is not that way. He is a proudly opinionated and aggregative blogger. But he was a huge exception in Philadelphia while I was there. So even folks with the, you know, the title blogger or the title aggregator, you know, would talk about what they were doing as in service of original reporting, and they would try to take the blogging rhythms and transform them to reporting ends. And, you know, Will was one of the few people, you know, kind of in the newsroom who, you know, sort of had this different self-identity as, you know, somebody who, you know, who did this other kind of thing. And, you know, I think that's not a coincidence that, you know, a lot of people outside of Philadelphia in the larger blogosphere or the larger digital journalism ecosystem know Will Bunch in a way that they don't know maybe some of the other bloggers in Philadelphia, because Will, you know, sort of saw himself as part of this community. whereas the others did not. And, you know, the other bloggers in Philadelphia, the other bloggers in you know, the larger media ecosystem recognized Will as one of their own, and they took him more seriously, and he was kind of entered into the fraternity, or the, you know, the tribe. The tribe, as it were. You know, and he was accepted in a different way. And watching the way that Will, you know, I thought that people doing blogging would all be doing the blogging that I did when I started blogging, and you do, and everybody does. And, you know, it's just these reporters, they just had a very, very different idea of what they were doing, why they were doing it, and what the process was.
Right. Well, it's I think easy to look at that sort of reporter attitude as being in the end self-defeating, and it's what's led to, you know, online native media lapping traditional media by lots of metrics and audience metrics. But given that you described your own movement bit more towards the idea of seeing value in the work that these institutions were doing, do you think that, like, can you defend that point of view, in that if you instead think original reporting, whether you put scare quotes around it or not, is the thing of most value that old line newspapers produce, does it make sense at all for the reaction to be, well, then hot damn, we're going to defend that, and that's what we're going to do, even if that means that we are perhaps, you know, not adapting as well? Is there a noblesse oblige to that sort of approach?
Yeah. No, that's a really good question. You know, I think there are two ways to kind of tackle that. And the one maybe sort of managerial answer to that is to say, like, oh, well, you know, let's just do it all, you know, and let's get better internal differentiation amongst, you know, in our own newsroom staff. You know, we're going to have people deliberately doing this other more Will Bunch aggregation kind of thing. And in doing that, we are somehow going to protect or service the folks who are doing the original reporting, which is what we really care about. That was a little garbled in my mind as I say it, but that's the basic idea, right? That you can if you managerially structure your organization so you have people doing all these different tasks, you can theoretically at least, you know, kind of protect the core,
right?
You can
the iron core,
right? Exactly, right. You can protect the iron core, although since it's iron, you know, you wonder why it would need protecting. But anyway, we don't want to push this metaphor too far, right? You can protect the core. Now, that's a manager solution. You know, the answer I might be more comfortable with, you know, is one to say that, you know, original reporting is really important, and the original reporting and the news work, I guess, or the news production that newspapers do is the most important thing that they do. But our definition of what original reporting is bizarrely truncated, right? And we need to see the production of content and news as more than simply, and this is very unfair, and this is not what all reporters do all the time, but I will say we need to see original reporting as being more than simply reading press releases, going to press conferences, and, you know, getting tips from people that, you know, we expect to get tips from, and calling people on our Rolodex when we need an expert opinion and we need to get it into a story, you know, before deadline at 5 p.m. And not all reporters do that, and not all reporters do that all the time, but a lot of reporters spend a lot of their time doing what I just said. And there's no reason why that should be called original reporting, you know, and reading 20 blogs a day and learning what different people in the city are saying about different topics, you know, there's no reason why what I just described should be seen as more important than the other thing, which is spending a lot of time online and reading what people are saying and following links and linking out and doing all that other stuff. So yeah, I think that original reporting is important. I think that original reporting, you know, is often a particular set of processes that are oversold, and maybe mythologized a little bit. And, you know, I just would like that definition to, you know, to loosen up a little bit. You know, I think we will have a healthier media production system if we can just, you know, just broaden your mind a little.
Right. I mean, I think it is some of the most compelling journalistic work that I've ever seen online is when you have someone who has a grounding in, let's say, the good piece of original reporting to siphon off that slice, but who also sort of is willing to engage directly with the public and to really break out story forms into a bloggy or a social media centric mentality.
Totally agree.
And to engage in some way. And I wonder if you talk about journalists' conception of themselves. I kind of wonder if part of it is also a managerial question of the way to do that, to be successful, involves a much more direct connection between the individual journalist and the audience. And that level of engagement, I argue, at least, I haven't done ethnographies to prove this, but you know, that's something that management is often not really comfortable with. And part of the process of taking lots of individual voices and molding them into one communal newspaper-wide voice is something that you almost have to give up if you want to make sure that the audience on a particular beat is going to have a connection with the individual reporter there. And that's why I kind of wonder, it's interesting that whether that would be different at the Daily News than at the Inquirer, which is a different conception of that.
No, exactly. And in fact, that was what I was just about to say in response to your question. You know, so the folks at the Daily News, and for people in the audience who don't know, that in Philadelphia Daily News is much like the New York Daily News. It is the tabloid. The Philadelphia Inquirer is, you know, the broadsheet. And they are both, as it turns out, owned by the same company, which is a whole other kettle of fish. But those are the two papers. People at the Philadelphia Daily News talked about that all the time. And what they would always say is, you know, now you have to understand there is a huge rivalry between these two papers still today. And they love to talk smack about each other. Again, even though they're owned by the same folks. But what the Daily News folks would say is, you know, hey, you know what? We're actually, as an institution, more suited for the web than those guys upstairs.
Sure.
Meaning the Inquirer. You know, we have personality. We have voice. We have, you know, attitude. You know, we have, you know, we're columnist driven, you know, as opposed to, you know, reporting driven. You know, we fit the web. The irony here is that due to the way resources were managed, all of the online investment, you know, in the Philly newspaper group was either done through Philly.com, which was a third site, which was kind of a aggregator of both the Inquirer and the Daily News. So a lot of the money went to Philly.com, and a lot of the money went to the Inquirer to start a breaking news, an online breaking news desk. Now that's also important, but you know, the Daily News was under-resourced when it came to its ability to get and do cool things online. And it was sort of really one of the paradoxes, you know, because they might have been, you know, more suited to the web world, you know, than the Inquirer was in particular ways. But, you know, they never had the tech chops to really make a mark there. And by the time that, you know, there might have been some rethinking of that, you know, the internet was already several stages past the blogosphere, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? Like it was, it had already moved on, you know, several steps already.
I want to get back to what we were talking about earlier on the idea of the mass public versus the niche and the ways in which, you know, a newspaper reporter might identify with that, which is interesting in its own way because, of course, any metro newspaper in particular is really an assemblage of a variety of niches. You know, the sports people aren't reading the investigations people may not be reading the comics may not be, you know, clipping the coupons, you know. This divided universe that just happens to live under this common umbrella, and the structure of the newsroom matches that, where you have someone who covers education but, you know, doesn't cover the Eagles. I'm curious if you could just talk a little bit more about that conception of mass audience and how did you get the impression, because I think a lot of journalists do get their feeling of importance and their internal fortitude from being part of this big organization. Did in the follow-up visits and conversations you've had since, and have you seen any evolution on how people view the mass audience? And now that they have a stronger perception that the mass is maybe not what it was 10 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so two sort of things on that. There was a phrase that, you know, when people were redesigning the Philly.com web page, you know, and they wanted to know kind of what their tagline was or what their slogan was, you know, the slogan that they chose was, you know, anything and everything Philadelphia. You know, that was the few words that they wanted to use to, you know, sort of sum up what they did. You know, and that again is this idea of the mass public, right? Like, even if we're in sports, you know, even if we're in architecture, even if we're in, you know, in you know, education reporting, you know, all of which themselves are niches, you know, we as an institution are the only ones who speak to the city, right? We're the only ones who actually talk to the city, and the city talks back to us. And it was really encapsulated in this slogan, you know, anything and everything, Philadelphia. You know, and one of the things the internet did was it increasingly showed these journalists that they were not everything Philadelphia. There was no way they could be everything Philadelphia. There was so much going on in Philadelphia that was represented online that they themselves didn't talk about or didn't capture or didn't write about. You know, they couldn't claim to be anything and everything Philadelphia in an online world anymore. Now, since in the last few years, you know, the question you asked was, you know, have they started to re-see or see the audience they speak to or the public they speak to differently? The short answer to that question is yes. And the people they speak to or the people they want to speak to are the people who will pay, right? So that actually has been a very, you know, interesting change in the newsroom mindset, and it has a lot to do with the institution of paywalls and the institution of, you know, pay fences, or whatever, you know, a meter model, whatever you want to call it. Journalists have been far more comfortable with the idea that the niche they speak to is the niche who will pay. And to me, that is a huge mindset shift in the way journalists think about what they do, which is why when paywalls always come up, you know, I always try to avoid the question of, you know, will they be economically successful or not? I mean, to me, they might, but that's not really the interesting question. The interesting question is how will the institutions of paywalls change the way journalists think about themselves and think about who reads them? You know, so I think they have gotten more comfortable with the idea of a niche audience. In a large way, that niche audience is sort of dominated by economic concerns. You know, I also think they are more comfortable in a more general way with the idea that, you know, the people who are going to read, you know, reporting from City Hall, you know, the City Hall Bureau are like the real news junkies, you know what I mean, or the city power players. I mean, I think they always knew that. I think they're more comfortable with admitting that now. Mm-hmm. So there is less monetary stuff going on as well. But, you know, the paywall argument or the meter argument or the, you know, how to get people to pay for this stuff argument, that has really taken the conversation about niches and the niche audience in some interesting directions that, you know, I wouldn't have necessarily anticipated when I started doing the research.
Yeah, because it's not that far of a leap from this is the people we think of the audience we're speaking to, these are the people we're speaking to these are the people we're speaking about, and to have the representation of the subject matter change to fit those sorts of interests. The way that if you read the Wall Street Journal, because of who the Wall Street Journal is speaking to, you're actually, you know, you're not going to be reading about community colleges. You're going to be reading about Harvard and Yale and Princeton and Wharton and the rest.
Indeed. I think that's exactly right.
It's also interesting to think about the concept of mass in the context of Philadelphia, because they specifically invested in Philly.com, the idea there would be a unified front that does do the high-low it takes the high-low split that the Inquirer and the Daily News had and unifies it into one whole and specifically says this is for everybody.
Right. Well, you know, and that was – I mean – the story of Philly.com, and I tell this in the book, is sort of the story of this kind of pendulum swinging back and forth between, you know, Philly.com as a honest to God aggregator of the content of the tabloids, the broadsheet, and kind of their own in-house staff of, you know, video producers. So the people doing original production at Philly.com when I was there, and this has changed, but when I was there, their original reporting was all done in the form of video. They did have a staff of video producers. That's one idea of Philly.com. Another idea of Philly.com, and the pendulum, like I said, has gone back and forth on this, is Philly.com as the Philadelphia Inquirer, you know, and that everything else is sort of relegated to second tier status, that it's not truly a aggregator of everyone in the newspaper group. It is a, you know, it is basically the Philadelphia Inquirer, you know, with a slightly different brand and a different URL, but that's what, you know, that's what Philly.com is. And, you know, this idea of what Philly.com should be has kind of swung back and forth depending on, you know, who's in the management at a particular time and, you know, how people think the web works and what people think the balance is between, you know, highbrow and lowbrow stuff. And, you know, and again, honestly, like I said, just to repeat, you know, so much of it is just, you know, who's on the top, who's the top dog in the news organization at that particular time? You know, are they an Inquirer person or a Daily News person or a, you know, a page views person? So that concept has not been static over time. It has really changed depending on both the structure of the organization and the larger sense of, you know, this is what's going on the web. We may see them moving back towards more of an Inquirer space at this point.
Yeah, I would say since they, you know, early 2013, they said they're going to split the Inquirer and the Daily News into separate sites and still have Philly.com as a free site, whereas the other two would be paywalled.
Yeah, and I think they're going to be saying, you know, and I think they're really going to be pushing for folks to go to the Inquirer. I mean, that is what I see.
Yeah,
when they talk about where to go.
Yeah, you've heard over the last several years regular threats of they're going to close the Daily News. You don't hear they're going to close the Inquirer in the same way.
No.
One of the other things that you talk about in the book is, and that goes throughout it, is the concept of networks and the ways in which. And at one level, networks can be viewed as – a network journalism can be viewed as an opposition to institutionalized journalism. But, of course, the institutions are a part of that network. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, you know, what you saw in terms of the evolution of that approach, you know, over the time that you're looking at. I will say the first time I ever heard a newspaper editor – I think a well-intentioned, you know, high-quality newspaper editor complain about collaboration fatigue – was a Philadelphia newspaper editor I won't name. And just the idea that particularly with the boomlet that was just starting when you were, you know, doing your immersion there, this boomlet of nonprofit sites and independent institutions who were sort of newspaper culture to an extent and wanted to work with them as a way to get their work out. I know a lot of people in Philadelphia and elsewhere found that to be a tiring process and in some ways almost an advertisement for the idea of a big institution where everyone works under one management. You can sort of direct people.
Yeah, no. I mean, again, you know, there was something of an evolution of my thinking on this. I came into the research and really ended the original phase of research in you know, 2009, you know, very convinced that the future of networked the future of journalism was kind of a more networked approach, a collaborative, you know, sort of cross-institutional people, you know, do what you do best and link to the rest, I guess, as, you know, Professor Jeff Jarvis would put it. I really bought into that when I was finishing up the main bulk of my first round of research. You know, I have since modified my perspective on that to say that collaboration is way harder than anyone thought it was. Collaboration takes way more time and energy than anyone thought it would. I think that counterargument is fair. But I would say that my response to that counterargument would be that, you know, you need to hire a deputy editor for collaboration. You know, I mean, you can't have this as being kind of a ad hoc, you know, process where we, you know, we kind of have this collaboration here and this collaboration there, and, you know, if we can get some money out of it, or if we can get, you know, a quote unquote exchange of value out of it, you know, we're going to do it. You know, no, this should be a, you know, masthead level position of somebody who, you know, is one or two steps down the editorial food chain and who just manages collaboration, you know, hire that person. Here's what I would say. I think you need a institutional approach to networks, right? You know, networks don't just form on their own and collaborations just don't happen on their own. You need to have one or two people at a place with the money and time to rationally manage how these connections are going to get made.
I think it's also – part of it is also, I would argue, an indictment of the sort of anti-aggregation or devaluation approach that a lot of newsrooms have, because, you know, one reason why collaboration is difficult is that you have two forces who are essentially working together to produce a product that will fit the voice of the big institution.
Yep.
You know, lots of, you know, nonprofit centers that end up working with a newspaper or a radio station or whatever else, you end up taking work and shoving it into a package that will work for them, whereas you know, collaboration could also be construed as, hey, this nonprofit did a really awesome story. We're going to link to it really prominently because we think our readers would be interested in it.
Indeed. And in fact, I have a whole chapter on this in the book where I basically kind of grapple with the idea that, you know, managerially speaking, it was far easier for these news organizations to enter formal content sharing partnerships that involved, you know, tons of meetings and contracts and, you know, white papers and plans. And, you know, it was easier for them to do that than it was to simply link to another person's story in another organization, right? You link. Linking takes like 2 seconds. You know what I mean? Like, you know, even say whatever you want about, you know, the problem with content management systems, you know, and linking, you know, linking is easier to do than creating a formalized partnership between two organizations that's going to be, you know, to be managed in all these ways, you know, but they couldn't link. And so I just sort of blew my mind. I said to myself, like, how is this possible? And you just described it in your own question, you know. So I think that deputy manager for collaboration would not simply be the person in those meetings, the person setting up those partnerships, but they would be they would educate people on that process, you know, that, look, you don't have to rewrite this story in order to put it in your own voice. You can simply link to it. And, you know, there's some social science research guys that says, you know, when you send people away from a newspaper website, that actually often brings more people back in. You know, news organizations still don't quite get that. So yeah, I think that's a hugely important point. And it was, you know, one of the puzzles I was really kind of wrestling with.
One of the other points that you raise that goes through the book that we can also tie into the report that you and Clay and Emily did recently is the idea of a post-industrial journalism and how the industrial workings of the newspaper, you know, persisted even though mm-hmm. they might have been constructed for a previous business context and a previous journalistic context and a distribution context. Mm-hmm. I guess I want to ask you a little bit more, because this was a question I had out of the post-industrial journalism report mm-hmm. too, is why industrial is the metaphor that you settled on, that report settled right. on? Because I think you could look at the kind of news work that's being created at a new tier of digitally native, you know, having no legacy origins mm-hmm. news organizations. And there's a similar sort of set of workflows and there's yep. a set of organizational yep. structures, and they might be different, but nonetheless, they are sort of industrial in the same sort of way, even though if they're not producing a physical product the way that a newspaper would.
Yeah, totally agree. You know, I was actually giving a talk up at Columbia yesterday, and one of the points I tried to make was to say, you know, there will never be no process, you know, in the way that news is produced. We will always have rational production processes. It's just that what those processes are changing. And, you know, what we're going to see is a new rational production process emerge and an old one go away. And where we are right now is that kind of moment of chaos where, you know, one is still operating and it doesn't make much sense, and another is emerging and no one really knows what it is. So yeah, I totally agree with you. You know, look, if left to my druthers, you know, I would probably have called the report, you know, post-routinized, mechanized news production or something horrible like that, right? I mean, you know, but thank God Emily and Clay would never, you know, let me do such a horrible thing.
But if you look at something like, you know, you look at Gawker Media, like that, yeah. they are routinized, they yeah. are mechanized, they have a production process that's at a different pace and it has different conceptions of what appropriate inputs and yeah. outputs are. But I guess that's part of my issue with it is that it post-industrial implies yep. that there won't be a system, that they'll just be this sort of grand collection of proteins in a primordial soup, and things will come out of it. And, you know, we're building new structures, not abandoning the idea of structure.
Yeah, no, I think I agree. I think one of the problems with the word industrial, it has this context of, you know, the old way being left behind, and there being no process at all. I mean, I think that, you know, in the context of that report, that title was really speaking to the traditional news organizations, to basically say, you know, and you can't get a new process until you have no until to some degree you're comfortable with having a bit of a chaotic process at first, right? Because these guys are going to perceive that transition from you know, their own way of doing it to the Gawker way of doing it, as
the
chaos.
World's worst thing.
Right, as chaos, right? As post-industrial, as, you know, there's nothing going on. And I guess that, you know, the polemical purpose in that title was to get the more traditional digitally non-native organizations to be comfortable with that idea. But that said, intellectually, I utterly and completely agree with you. Describing my sort of ism in scholarship, I would probably call myself a Weberian, which is the ideas of Max Weber, who is a sociologist, who basically argues that, you know, the main trend in modern society is towards increasing routinization and industrialization. And I do think that's true. And I think that perhaps the most interesting thing that's going online is to watch, you know, the Weberian gears grind and, you know, watch these very ad hoc kind of sites and processes become industrialized. So intellectually, I agree with you. Polemically, there was sort of a reasoning as to why we call it post-industrial.
Sure, it's a useful metaphor, and it gets the point across. I'm just quibbling.
No, but I think you're right. I think you're totally right on. And I think the reason the way we try to get at this in the report was to say, you know, it was to encourage the increasing routinization of digital, you know, of digital first players, you know, right. And not just routinization, but, you know, for them to share what their operations were as much as they could without giving trade secrets away.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think it would benefit the Philadelphia Inquirer to know what Gawker's routines were.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would really help them. I think that, you know, to the degree they can educate, you know, sort of the pre-industrial print folks as to what they actually do to get this stuff out, would be a hugely helpful process.
Last question. I want to ask you about what is interesting. So Neiman Lab started in 2008. So I think that I've been following closely in this role the same arc of time that this book, the research covers roughly. And I'm gonna put forward a series of suppositions. You can tell me whether they're right or not. I'm guessing that when you started this out, from what you've described and my other guesses, and I think what the tenor was in 2008, despite the fact that the journalism world as we knew it was sort of falling down all around us, I think there was an optimism that these new structures would come up and that the jobs that were performed by, you know, the big metro newspapers, or, you know, insert whatever news entity you want there, were going to be performed by new entities, and that those jobs were going to transition, and there was going to be a terrible time in the middle where things were getting done in to lesser degrees, or, you know, mm-hmm. there were problems, but that the institutions would arrive.
Yeah.
And I personally look at the metro scale news landscape in cities across the United States, and I see a whole lot of places where those institutions have not arrived and show no real sign of arriving.
Yeah.
And that we're seeing the decline of one thing, and less optimism. And I, you know, despite all the good things that have happened in the last years, less optimism that those jobs are going to be filled. Did you have that optimism 5 years ago, and how has that changed since then?
I did have that optimism 5 years ago. Although I will say I ended the research, you know, in 2009, incredibly depressed, because I, you know, the newspapers had just kind of declared bankruptcy, and I, you know, knew a bunch of really cool journalists who were, you know, facing, you know, sort of bleak employment prospect. That's sort of the flip side of being an ethnographer, is you actually get to really like the people you're hanging out with. So I was sort of spiritually bleak. I was intellectually optimistic, as you said, that, you know, that these new structures would emerge to fill these roles. You know, I agree with you. I think that it's not as if, you know, these roles, these political and public roles that news organizations filled are going to come back in the same way that they did. That, however, ties into where we started this conversation, which is to say that I think what is really going on, and we can only see the very vague outlines of this at this point, is that politics and the idea of public accountability are changing in massive ways. I think, you know, and how to bring that a little closer to the ground. You know, maybe the urban metropolitan center is no longer the terrain on which, you know, public affairs should be reported, right? You know, maybe the communities of interest in different cities that kind of get united, you know, horizontally, you know, so you're interested in particular issues in Denver and Des Moines and Austin, you know, maybe those are those kind of interest group grounds are the grounds on which politics, you know, and public affairs will be reported on in the future, as opposed to what's happening in this city. Does that make sense? I mean,
well, I get that argument. I guess my main concern about that, though, is that that would be great if our democratic institutions were flexible enough to make similar shifts. I mean, at the end, we're still going to have state legislators. We're still going to have city councils. We're going to have city halls and county sheriffs. And those institutions are still going to be tied to geography. And we had this wonderful accident where for, you know, a century or so, the journalistic institutions were aligned geographically with the governance institutions, and the web doesn't seem to support that same focus on geography.
Yeah, and again, you know, completely agree. And I think that, which is why, you know, if I had to say, you know, what should I, you know, I'm a politically passionate, you know, I'm, you know, you're like – somebody's like I was, you know, 15 years ago. I'm a politically passionate 20-year-old. What do I want to – you know, I want to go out there and change the world. What do I want to do? I would say, you know, get in there and change the way government works. You know, like the terrain of struggle is going to be on bringing those political structures, dragging them forward into a way that makes sense in the culture and in the information system that we have now. You know, and it seems impossible. It seems hard to believe that they will ever get there. But, you know, I mean, the progressive movement did it to some degree. You know, they radically changed the way government functioned, you know, and the way government related to its citizens. And they did it largely for the kind of reasons we're talking about here, you know, that information was changing and industry was changing and the scale upon which politics happened was changing. You know, and that's all happening again. And we need, you know, so don't. I guess I always say this, you know, in conversations with journalists, and I always get, you know, people are like, well, you're a journalism scholar. Why do you say this? But, you know, for me, what happens in journalism is less important than what happens in the institutions and the entities that journalism is supposed to be reporting on. That is where the real future, and whether this is a happy story or a sad story, that is where we're going to find the answer to that question. You know, can we get politics to match where we are right now? And that's what we should be. You know, if we have money to donate or volunteer time to give, that is where we should be focusing our energy, not necessarily on, you know, the future of news, basically.
Well, I thoroughly disagree with that last point, because the future of news is the most important area for money to be thrown. But
that is yes, no, but
that's,
you know,
a selfish point of view.
Yes, no, it you know, it's sort of your day job versus your free time, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Well, this has been great. Thanks for chatting with us. Appreciate it.
No, thanks, Josh. It was great. Thank you.
Well, that's episode 5 of Press Publish. Hope you enjoyed it. You can find links to Chris's book and everything else we talked about in today's episode in the show notes at NiemannLab.org. And for the record, it's never a bad time to brush up on your Max Weber. If you have any suggestions for guests we should have on future episodes, please do get in touch. You can reach me at joshua_benton@harvard.edu. Many, many thanks to our listeners. You guys have downloaded these episodes over 18,000 times, and that's just through the first 4 episodes. I really do appreciate it. New this week, you can listen to all of our episodes of Press Publish on SoundCloud, if that's the place you like to do your listening. You can find all our episodes as a set at the main Harvard site there, which is at soundcloud.com/Harvard. And by the way, you can also subscribe to the podcast within iTunes U, also in the Harvard section. The Nieman Journalism Lab is a project of the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard University, home of the Nieman Fellowships, Nieman Reports Magazine, Nieman Storyboard, and much, much more. Find us at nieman.harvard.edu, and that is N-I-E-M-A-N, not like Nieman Marcus. This episode was recorded at Walter Lippmann House. Walter Lippmann, who said, "Within the life of the generation now in control of affairs, persuasion has become a self-conscious art and a regular organ of popular government. None of us begins to understand the consequences, but it is no daring prophecy to say that the knowledge of how to create consent will alter every political calculation and modify every political premise." That's from Public Opinion, 1922. Our theme music again is Missing You by Trash 80. Check back next week for another episode of Press Publish. But until then, always remember, disrupt yourself before someone else disrupts you.